labels, so they try to distribute their own stuff. And when you do that, while you can remain pure to your ideology or whatever, it's a lot harder to get your records out there. It's a little easier now with indie and so on, but even now, indie labels often get picked up.
Okay, Ron, we gotta run. I'm sorry to cut this short. You know, this has been really fascinating. There's so many different threads to go that we could go in, and it's the 50th anniversary year of so much stuff this year, and it will continue to be. People continue to reflect on this. I urge people to pick up your book, Daydream Sunset, the 60s Counterculture in the 70s, and to call us up, 877-500-5266. Thank you so much, Ron Jacobs.
Thanks for having me, and thanks to everybody who listened, and hi to my friends in Portland. Talk to you later.
All right.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Elephant Revival, Thursday, September 10th at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. Elephant Revival is a five-piece band from Colorado that play folk music with Gypsy, Celtic, and Americana influences. The show is originally scheduled for Revolution Hall, and all tickets for that show will be honored. Again, that's Elephant Revival, Thursday, September 10th, 10:30 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Let the fires burn tonight. Let the jugs of wine get drunk.
KBOO would like to thank the restaurants that donated food for our volunteers today. Kenny and Zooks for providing breakfast. They have three locations in Portland serving pastrami, bagels, sandwiches, and other deli items. Located at 1038 Southwest Stark, 3901 North Williams, and 2376 Northwest Thurman. Apriza Mexican Cuisine for providing lunch. Serving Mexican cuisine for takeout and drive-thru in a recycled shipping container located at 2311 Southeast 8th Avenue. Archena for providing dinner located at 7742 Southeast 13th, serving Italian cuisine using ingredients from local Portland area farmers.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9:01, and here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. First, Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher speaks with Kentaro Toyama about his new book, Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. And at 9:30, we speak with Kate Harding about her book, Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre, and at 10:15, Flashpoints. Today, Randy Credico talks about being on the front lines fighting to control police violence and the prison industrial complex. And then at 11, we've got The Dirt Bag with host Glenn Andreessen. Today, welcoming back John Saltvliet to talk about his productive gardening style, edible weeds, food forests, and medicinal plants. And for now, we're going to go right to Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher with her guest.
Thank you. Good morning on this opening day of Pledge Drive at KBOO Radio Portland, of which I'm a proud and privileged to be a member and a volunteer. Computers in Bangalore are locked away in dusty cabinets because teachers don't know what to do with them. Mobile phone apps meant to spread hygiene practices in Africa fail to improve health. Executives in Silicon Valley evangelize novel technologies at work, even as they send their kids to Waldorf School that ban the electronics. And four decades of incredible innovation in America have done nothing to turn the tide of rising poverty and inequality. This is a direct quote from author Kentaro Toyama's book, Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. Welcome, Mr. Toyama.
That's right.
Oh, yes. Well, welcome. First of all, I want to say that, give a little background, and you are the W.K. Kellogg Associate Professor at the University of Michigan School of Information and a fellow of the Dalai Lama Center for Ethics and Transformative Values at MIT. And you previously the co-founder and assistant managing director of Microsoft Research India. You graduated from Yale with a PhD in computer science and from Harvard with a bachelor's in physics. I want to say that your background was so interesting in terms of reading the book because it really felt like an insider from some of us who aren't. First of all, welcome. And I want to make note that you first described yourself at one time as a technoholic. And I've often described myself as a technophobe. So this should be a really interesting conversation.
Although I may have moved a little bit closer to your end of the spectrum.
Well, good. This will be a very interesting conversation, especially from, like I said, the interesting and important thing that I first noted is that you feel like an insider. So why don't you begin telling us a little bit about how you earned the first moniker and at least the experiences that contributed to kind of describing yourself as a technoholic?
So I am a computer scientist by training, and by technoholic, what I meant was not so much that I'm addicted to gadgets, although I certainly use my share of them, but more that I was addicted to a particular method of problem solving, which is to believe that many of the complex problems of our world can be solved entirely through engineering, primarily of digital technologies.
Yes, and interestingly, that you maybe start with a little bit of your initial young background, but also remind us that you were with in Redmond, Washington, close by with Microsoft in 2004, when a trip really changed and informed your life in an introduction to poverty that resurfaces throughout the book.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was young, I always had this belief that I would eventually become either a scientist or an engineer. My, you know, parents bought me all kinds of, you know, engineering toys like Erector sets and Legos and even some electronic toys back in those days. I always thought that, you know, I would eventually grow up and solve big problems in, let's say, energy or something like that. And so I went through most of my schooling training to be a scientist of some kind. I majored in physics and then did a PhD in computer science. And from computer science, I went straight to Microsoft Research, which is basically a large computer science research lab. And for the first 7 years, I did research in a very technical area of computing called computer vision, which is to help computers effectively understand imagery and video. And after 7 years of that, I began to feel that, you know, it's one thing to develop new technology, but what I really wanted was to have a little bit more wider impact on society as a whole. And so when my manager, who is Indian at the time, decided that he was going to go to India to start a new research lab in India for Microsoft, I joined him. And I changed research direction. I began to investigate how technologies could be used to support poverty alleviation in the developing world.
Yes, a huge turning point. And throughout the book, you start to see how the recognition that you make the link throughout the book, and you state that almost every social problem, either directly or by analogy, is about poverty, and that being poor means having lower levels of health, education, and in particular, political power.
Yes, and you know, when I first went to India, I thought that, you know, at least some chunk of those problems could be addressed in some way by providing people the right kind of information or the right kind of information communication tools. And so we ran all kinds of projects. When I went to India, I started a research group that was typically about 10 people, half of whom were social scientists and half of whom were technologists like me. So we did projects in education and healthcare and agriculture and governance and on and on. And after 5 years and 50-odd projects, I came to a somewhat unexpected conclusion, which was that while the technology can help in certain instances, it was very far from being the primary solution.
Yes, which is the core of the book. I want to remind our listeners that we've been speaking with author Kentaro Toyama about his book, Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. Yes, well, in reading the book, you know, one of the things that I thought was interesting is the engaging stories that gave insight both from the people who support your concern and effort, but also people in the industry that present the more expected narrative. Can you give us a couple examples of each? Because that's what was so engaging, these stories about different people.
Sure, absolutely. You know, one of the things that I remember that kind of, you know, strengthened this realization that technology just isn't the solution in many cases was when I went to visit a school in which one of our projects was being rolled out. And the it was a government school. There were about 40 children in a classroom. I think it was 6th or 7th grade. And the teacher was, you know, very eager to show off how he was using one of our tools, which involved a projector and a laptop. And at the beginning of the class, he, you know, started fiddling with the computer because he couldn't get the screen to come up. And it seemed like, you know, over time that the children were getting a little bit more antsy. They were originally in very disciplined straight lines, but then they started jumping out of their seats because nothing was happening. I stepped in to help, and we had to plug in the power ultimately to a different outlet, reboot the computer. And after all this was done, 20 minutes of a 45-minute class was basically over. And I thought, you know, if this is the kind of thing that happens even occasionally, then it's not clear to me that we are ultimately helping education by pushing computers into these schools.
Yes, and you paint a very empathetic picture of the teachers, and here they are in sometimes these subpar classrooms with very little other supports, both technically, clearly, and also from people, and they are supposed to take on this daunting task of these new technologies that that they themselves don't even feel entirely comfortable with.
That's right. You know, I very consistently found that, you know, most of the teachers that we interacted with really wanted to teach well, but they were often missing the larger support that they would, you know, that anybody would need to teach well. You know, their administrations were often not particularly focused on learning. They were focused on getting through a certain curriculum at any cost. And then with respect to technology, there was often, I mean, almost always, there was no IT support of any kind. And so, you know, these teachers had to become technical experts just to get to the point where they could meaningfully use technology.
Yes. And again, throughout the book, there's so many personal accounts of fabulous and interesting, curious people and caring that I know it would be hard in the short time that we have to explore all of them, but I wonder if you have one story that you think kind of best shares your idea. I know maybe the taxi cab driver or that starts to question the whole premise of this.
Yeah, absolutely. There are so many stories, in fact. I suppose, you know, the one that I could tell is a little bit about how we tend to think of a lot of social change as being very quick and external. But the reality is that, you know, we should see it more like learning how to play a musical instrument. And you know, things like economic growth or democratization require that there's an entire population that has different habits of mind and different social norms, all of which take a long time to learn and to acquire and to practice. One of the stories I tell in the book is of how Venezuela has become an amazing country for classical music as a result of a program called El Sistema. This is a program that was founded by a man who was both an economist and a classical musician, Jose Abreu. And what he felt was that, you know, his country previously only had orchestras that were peopled by musicians who came from abroad. The country could hire them based on their oil money, but they didn't train their own musicians from within the country. So he wanted to start an orchestra that was made up of Venezuelans. And over the decades, he built initially one orchestra composed initially of people who, you know, largely could not play their own musical instruments. But that orchestra went on to do quite well under his direction, and eventually it multiplied into many orchestras. And today, Venezuela has something like 400,000 students of classical music scattered all across the country. The phenomenon is so embraced by the entire population that apparently you can go into rural areas and find that the cows out there are named Mozart and Beethoven. In 2007, the Los Angeles Philharmonic, one of the best orchestras in the world, hired Gustavo Dudamel as its music director, and Dudamel was a product of this system in Venezuela. So this is an amazing transformation that took place. And what's interesting about this kind of social transformation is that, you know, there are just no shortcuts to it. It takes years of practice on the part of all the people who are involved. It takes a culture that, you know, begins to become enthusiastic about it. And it doesn't make a difference how good your metronome is or how many MP3 players are. You just can't turn somebody into a quality musician through technology.
Well, and that was what, and I want to remind our listeners that this book that we've been discussing, Geek Heresy, as you say, the core thesis of it is that we should see social situations less as problems to be solved and more as people and institutions to be nurtured, and that in the 21st century, what we need more of are the right kinds of hearts, mind, and will. So I want to let our listeners know, at least right now, that they can also get this book at the, you know, after we're through the interview, and many more like it, by calling 877-500-5266. And also use the technology available to get online and pledge. And speaking of that, I know that you were saying that when you came back to the United States in kind of an attempt to find out what to do about what you discovered, you stated that theorists fall roughly into four camps: technological utopians, technological skeptics, contextualists, and social determinists. Can you explain a little bit about what you meant then?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So technological utopians, as it sounds, are people who believe that technology solves, you know, just about every kind of problem eventually, and that, you know, one day we'll be led to a utopia that is technology-driven. Technological skeptics are people who hold kind of the opposite view. They have a very dark view of technology and think that, if anything, we are not paying enough attention to technology's dark side, and eventually it'll be our undoing. Contextualists are people who believe that the technology's impact depends very much on the larger context, and that the context is different from instance to instance. And I believe that they are largely right, except that the theory is very difficult to draw any conclusions from, because basically the lesson is, well, you know, everything is case by case. And social determinants ultimately are a certain class of contextualists who believe that ultimately technology is up to people and human institutions to wield, and therefore what matters most is what people do with the technology. And I subscribe to a theory that is, you know, ultimately social determinist in nature, that as much as technology does have certain kinds of tendencies and biases, that ultimately it's up to us as the wielders of the tools to decide, first of all, whether or not to use it at all, and second of all, how we use it. In the book, I talk about what I call technology's law of amplification, which is that technology amplifies underlying human forces, whether they are good or bad. And one thing that I believe is the case is anytime we see technology having positive impact, that's because it's happening on a foundation of good human intention and capacity. And technology's negative impact often comes from, again, human bad intentions, or possibly neglect, because we are willing to accept the good side of technology but pretend that the bad side doesn't exist.
Yes, and you know, one of the most important quotes in the book, I think it was from Melvin Kratzberg, and he wrote in 1986 that technology is neither good nor bad, but, and I thought this was critical, nor is it neutral.
Yes, that's right. And I think what he meant by that is that, you know, technology obviously has some kind of impact, but it's not predetermined to be good or bad.
Yes. So you also throughout the book, there's you talk about the modern society's fetishes around technocratic kind of devices. But you also state over and over again that it's a human finger on the switch and a human hand at the controls. Why, you asked, are you so enamored with the shrink wrap fixes? And why do those of you who even know better tout them as the solutions? One of the things that I thought was so interesting, again, is I felt like you were an insider. And not that those of us who are not immersed in the technology like you are have no understanding of it, but I wondered if sometimes the inside noise is so loud by the people in the bubble that they don't see what we do, or what are your feelings about your colleagues in that regard?
Right. So, you know, I think that as a scientist and an engineer, we, and I'm certainly one of them, you know, we are almost by temperament the kind of people who want to find shortcuts to difficult problems. I mean, that's what drives us. That's what drives engineering, is to believe that there is a better, faster, easier, cheaper way to accomplish certain kinds of goals. And there's no doubt that that drive has, you know, really brought human civilization forward in dramatic ways. I mean, you know, even just compared to 200 years ago, our civilization is dramatically different, and in many ways, at least for the wealthier of us, is incredibly improved, and it's all because of technology. On the other hand, I do think that there are many problems for which there just is not a shortcut. There is no easy way out, and we simply have to put in the hard work to accomplish those goals. And many of those problems have to do with change in people, change in society, change in individuals. So just for example, education, a good education requires that the student put in a significant amount of effort, and there's really no shortcut to learning the things that we would like, you know, the average citizen to learn. K through 12th education, I think of it as an intellectual Mount Everest in how difficult it really is, because you're effectively trying to reconstruct the thinking of the best minds, you know, over the last several millennia, and compressing that into a 12-year time period. You know, that's a significant feat for anybody. And yet we seem to keep thinking that this very difficult feat that requires a lot of effort on the part of the student is something that we can simplify through the use of technology. And more research is discovering that, in fact, it doesn't matter too much how much more technology you have at play. What matters most is the quality of the adult supervision that's involved.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And like I said, for our listeners, it comes in such a thoughtful form that it feels easy to digest. And there's so many personal accounts of fabulous and interesting, curious and caring people. I mean, the attributes in the end are really telling about both you, the sensitivity that you bring to it, the understanding. It really is a wonderful book, and you ask the fabulous and important questions throughout the book, or at least explore them. So I want to remind our listeners that I've been speaking with Kentaro Toyama about his new book, Geek Heresy. Do you want to quickly tell us where that title came from and by whom?
Yeah, I owe the title to a good friend of mine who is a journalist who writes about international development, Tom Paulson of Humanosphere. Several years ago, and I think it was the first time we met, he wrote an article about my work and about my research in India. And I think it was headlined Geek Heretic, because I was saying things that were heretical to a certain class of technologists.
Yes. And it really does a good job of addressing the issue that's so important and valuable to all of us right now. Well, I want to thank you for being with us and sharing this really interesting, visionary, thoughtful book. I want to remind our listeners that they can get this as a premium for pledging, and they can receive a copy of this and many books throughout our pledge drive. KBOO is your community radio station, and this book and many like it support the values that KBOO and listeners like you do. I want to thank you so much. Mr. Toyama, for being with us, for your effort, your energy, your contribution to both the world and to KABU.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It's really been a pleasure. I mean, you state that throughout the book, some of us have influence on the lives of 10 people, others on 1,000 people, and still others on millions. And you also state, and you are right, that the closer we are to being the best version of ourselves, the better the outcome for everyone we touch.
I hopefully that will influence as many of your listeners as possible.
Yes. Thank you again for being with us. Again, this is KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
And thank you, Michelle, and thank you, Mr. Toyama, for writing this great book, Geek Heresy. And be the best version of yourself by becoming a member of KABU today at the $5 a month level and pick up a copy of this book by calling 877-500-5266. My name's Sun Lee. I'm joined with Justin Miller. I'm the membership director here at the station. And one thing I'd like to say before we get started is that thank you to everyone who donated early. We were able to raise $15,000 before the drive began, so we will have one less day of interrupted programming. And due to that overwhelming support and generosity, you know, our goal has gone from $95,000 to $80,000 for this drive now. And please do your part by giving us a call, 877-500-5266.
It's certainly a wonderful way to start the fall membership drive, with already having ticked a day off the calendar. And so we're so grateful for everyone who gave early and often. And now we're kind of opening up the gates and asking everyone near and far who's listening right now to consider making a modest monthly contribution to the mighty 90.7. Maybe 10 people can call up. Maybe give at that $120 level. It amounts to 33 cents a day, or a modest $10 a month on that sustaining giver program. You can call us at 877-500-5266. Perhaps you are also geek heretics and you're listening all around the world on the intertubes, and you are welcome to make your donation securely there at kboo.fm. You know, I was just thinking about that last line, that we may influence a few, we may influence many. KABU has influenced millions and millions of people now at around 24 million commercial-free minutes, and we're hoping that that will remind you not to take us for granted and make sure that we can influence millions more when you call with your contribution at 877-500-KBOO.
And of course, if you are unable to access a phone at the moment, you can always donate online at kboo.fm/give. And when you're on our website, be sure to check out all the specials that we have lined up for this fall membership drive. We've got some great program coming up over the next 10 days. And pick up your book of Geek Heresy by calling 877-500-5266 for a $60 minimum pledge. That's $5 a month, folks, either from a credit or debit card or from your checking account. It's the most secure and stable funding that the station can get, and we do recommend that you become a monthly donor. And it's very simple to do. And one of the goals that I have as the membership director here at the station is to decrease the number of days that we're on the air interrupting programming to raise money. And one of the ways to do that is to, right now, currently about 44% of our 4,500 members give monthly. If we could increase that number to about 50 to 55%, we can shorten these membership drives and give you more more programming with less interruptions. Please call 877-500-5266.
Because, of course, we are a mission-driven organization, and our mission is not to raise money per se. Our mission is to serve the community. We raise the money to keep the lights on and the doors open. Though I would also say it is an exciting time during membership drives, because we get to sort of interact more directly with our supporters, with the phones ringing and people coming in off the streets to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. So we're grateful for that. But I was just thinking, you know, Michelle has done, she's a stalwart volunteer and has done some great interviews, and I was thinking, what a great great way to bring high tech and low tech together, because I believe there are a lot of so-called geek heretics listening right now. KBOO is this fabulous mixture of high tech and low tech. We come at this. When I first started working here, we were cutting reel-to-reel tape with razor blades and putting it back together with Scotch tape. And now we're streaming on the internet to people all over the world. That's an astonishing combination of high tech and low tech. It's only happened because of one reason, and that is you, listeners, in radio land, in webitude land, calling and making that support, clicking on the link and making donations. It's allowed us to steadily increase our technology, which allows us to give you more service and educate the people, which was something that Mr. Toyama was saying was incredibly important. So please remember all of that when you move to your phone and consider starting a new monthly donation. You know, whether that's $5 a month or $50 a month, it's most important that you get involved and let us add you to the good books. Call right now, 877-500-5266. If you're anywhere in North America, you can do that toll-free. Anywhere in the world with a wired box, you can make that donation at kboo.fm. And we've got more radio coming up, I reckon.
Yes, we do. Thank you, son. Thank you, Justin. Stay tuned at 10 o'clock for Eric Cascady on KBOO, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints follows, and then at 11, it's The Dirtbag with host Glenn Andreessen. And right now, we're going to go to Kathleen Stevenson speaking with Kate Harding about her book, Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for Political Perspectives. I'm with writer Kate Harding. She is the author of the new book, Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. Kate is the co-author of Lessons from the Fatosphere and a contributor to the Book of Jezebel. Kate Harding, welcome. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Why did you want to write this book?
A couple of reasons. One is that I am a rape survivor. About 23 years ago now, I was raped in college. And so it's something that has obviously been close to my heart since then. But also around 2012, when I started working on this, it just seemed like there were so many instances of rape culture showing up in the news every day without anyone kind of